This is Ben Smith. I'm a photographer, and this is my podcast, A Small Voice, Conversations with Photographers. Thanks for listening. Hello, folks. It's Ben here. This is my podcast, A Small Voice, Conversations with Photographers. Thanks for joining me for the first of 2021. I hope you enjoyed the kind of end-of-year special that I did around Christmas, if you've listened to that already. If you haven't listened to it, then why not, for God's sake, go back and have a listen. It's got some good little kind of reminders of who I had on over the period of 2020, the year that I think will lodge in all of our memories. But 2021 not looking all that much better to start with, is it? Let's face it, we are in full lockdown in the UK, as most of you will probably know. I just hope things are better wherever you are. If you are in sort of Australia or New Zealand, then well done. You are rocking it. And the rest of us not looking so good. But anyway, the point is, I can continue to do A Small Voice podcast under any circumstances, because as you know, we can talk to people remotely, as I have been all of this year, or at least for most of it. And so hopefully I'm going to bring you some good chats as the year unfolds. I'm wittering on. Let me just get to the business. My guest this week is the fantastic Evgenia Arbogaeva. And I will introduce Evgenia properly after I've given you a little bit of housekeeping. If you want a bit more small voice in your life and you're only listening every 2 weeks, you can have it once a week by becoming a member and accessing the exclusive fortnightly members only episode. So you get an episode each week effectively. And you can join up for £5 a month at pod.fan to access that special content, which includes the previous guests answering their 20 bonus questions. Quite often, every bit as interesting as the main chat, that catch-ups and check-ins with former guests, all the occasional specials from festivals, openings and events and more. Well, when that happens, yeah. You can also show your support and help fund the ongoing production of the podcast by signing up as a supporter of the show for £3 a month, or by making a larger periodic, occasional or one-off donation. And you can do all that at pod.fan. Just go to pod.fan and you'll find this podcast on there. Leave me a positive review on iTunes if you wouldn't mind. That'd be great. The episode that you're listening to is brought to you, as usual, by the brilliant Charcoal Book Club, which is the first and only Book of the Month club dedicated exclusively to photo books. Each month, Charcoal works with the most respected names in contemporary photography to select a first edition monograph that is a must-have for every collection. Each book arrives signed by the artist, along with a note card and a print from an esteemed guest curator. Free shipping to the USA, Canada and the UK. All that along with members-only pricing and their online bookstore and more makes the Charcoal Book Club, as you know, the best and most exciting way to stay up to date with essential work in contemporary photography. I just got the January Book of the Month, which is a corker. It's a Mark Steinmetz book. It's called South Central. And, wow, nice to have that just come through. Just as the winter really kind of starts to unfold, and what with lockdown and all that, books are very much welcome. Anyway, Evgenia Arbogaeva, my guest this week, was born and spent her early childhood in the secluded town of Tiksi, located on the shore of the Laptev Sea in the Republic of Yakutia in Russia's Arctic North. Though she's now based in London and recently lived for a number of years in New York City, she has spent much of the past decade returning to and exploring the region surrounding her birthplace, discovering and capturing the remote world she finds there and the isolated characters who inhabit them. Her work is often located within the tradition of magical realism, and her approach combines documentary and narrative styles to create a distinctive visual iconography rooted in real experience but resonant with fable, myth and romanticism. I ripped off that last sentence from, I think, some bio on the Photographer's Gallery website, so thank you to the Photographer's Gallery for providing that little nugget of explanation as to Evgenia's work. Evgenia's early series Tiksi in 2010 and Weatherman 2013, which featured Slava, a lone Russian meteorologist willingly marooned on a remote weather station, reflect her romantic fascination and childhood nostalgia for the Arctic. Between 2018 and 2019, supported by a National Geographic Society Storytelling Fellowship, Evgenia travelled to three more outposts in the extreme north of Russia, creating three further chapters: Kanin Nos, a lighthouse on the isolated Kanin Peninsula, populated only by a young couple and their dog; Dixon, a now derelict ghost town where Evgenia captured the spectacular northern lights; and finally, the far northeastern region of Chukotka, home to the Chukchi community, who still maintain the traditions of their ancestors, living off the land and sea with walrus and whale meat as the main components of their diet. Collectively, these stories are entitled Hyperborea and are featured in a major solo exhibition at the Photographers' Gallery in London, now sadly closed, of course, under the latest UK lockdown. So, unfortunately, even if you're in London, you will not get to see that show now. Hopefully some of you may have got to see it before, but it was scheduled to run, I think, until February. By way of geographical contrast, Evgenia also went to Tanzania in 2016 to document a former malaria research centre, producing a story entitled Amani, the name of the place in question. As well as being a National Geographic Society Storytelling Fellow, Evgenia is a recipient of the ICP Infinity Award, the Leica Oscar Barnack Award, and the Magnum Foundation Emergency Fund Grant. Her work has been exhibited internationally and appeared in publications such as National Geographic, Time, Le Monde, and the New Yorker magazines, among others. I was really glad to get Evgenia on. I've been admiring her work for some time, since I think the first time I ever saw Weatherman, which was the story that, you know, alerted me to her existence and to the existence of her photography. And I've been enjoying her work very much ever since. So I hope you also enjoy this chat I had with Evgenia Arbogaeva. Thanks for joining me. It's really nice to have you on. Hopefully I will have done the usual sort of intro, so the listeners, if they don't already know your work, which I hope a lot of them will, they'll at least have some sense of these fantastic places that you go to. Where have you just recently come back from?
I just came back from Chukotka. It's in eastern Russia. I was there for almost 3 months. We had a chance to kind of escape when in summer, when it was kind of a bit calmer. And then I came back missing everything, you know, the new wave and the U.S. election and all of this. So I actually feel it was quite a good thing that I did miss all that.
Yeah. Now, like Chukotka, is that the place where you did the mammoth hunters? Is that the place?
No, mammoth hunters I photographed in Yakutia, which is my home region. But Chukotka is actually, it's bordering with Yakutia. It's in the same area. But Chukotka is the region that borders with Alaska by Bering Strait.
Uh-huh. Okay. And so, basically, you went sort of towards the end of the summer, beginning of the autumn. So it wasn't like middle of, you know, like the darkness and all that. You seem to quite like to go at that time of year when there isn't much light, which, you know, for a photographer is an interesting choice, but you seem to have made that work brilliantly well. Did you have a bit of both in this case then?
No, actually, in this case, it was a normal amount of light. Actually, it's this rare moment of kind of normality, if we speak about day and night and in how we experience it here, meaning that there was enough. There was day and there was night, and it's this kind of period of transition from summer to winter. So in autumn, you get normal night, normal day, but closer to October, we already started to have quite long nights. So the day started to be shorter and shorter.
Mm. You've referred to this place, Chukotka, as a difficult place. I mean, I'm sure you mean sort of physically and in terms of just the sort of the sheer kind of wildness of it, but is it difficult in other ways as well?
Oh, it's difficult on so many levels. Physically, I mean, I wouldn't say physically, it's not more difficult than any other places I've been to. Emotionally, I think it's quite difficult because I was photographing hunters, Chukchi community and the Nurm in the village, and I was going hunting with them, almost every time they go. So they were hunting whales and walruses, and that's, you know, it's a challenging experience, especially if it happens so often. If you go out, you know, because the time of hunting is quite short. It's seasonal, so when they go out, if the weather is good, they go out every day and all day, stay in the sea, and it's a bit difficult to participate in the hunt when it's so intense and so many animals are being hunted. But at the same time, of course, I understand that this is for the people, and that's how they've been living for centuries, and this is in their culture. It's just, for me personally, was a little hard, but I got used to that. Also, it's difficult because it's not, you know, it's quite, I would say, not, you know, quite poor region in Russia, quite remote. So you see, kind of everything, all the priorities shift somehow there. And you see how people live with so little, and difficult to see how the country doesn't support regions that are so far away. I mean, there are so many things in Chukotka I feel like whatever you see, whatever you touch is quite intense there. I mean, obviously the history of Soviet colonization and climate change and all of this, it feels like just all these issues are just there.
Mm. And what, the first time you ever went there, was there an assignment that didn't actually kind of pan out? Is that how you first came to go there?
Yes, first I got an assignment to, it was an issue for a magazine about borders. So they were looking into border between Russia and America, so Bering Strait. And I was hoping to go and photograph some of the places that was not permitted to go because they're closed for civilians. It's military bases. So that didn't work out. But I'm really happy that I got to go and just to see this place. And I knew that I have to come back. It's just so... Mm. Probably the most interesting place I've been to ever, really. It's dark, but also it's very intense and interesting and very challenging in many ways, and that's why I think it's worth going.
Yeah, well, if that's the most interesting place you've been to, that's really saying something, because you've definitely been to some interesting places by the standards of most of us. And I do want to sort of, I think I've been thinking about how to do it, and I you know, the simplest thing is to kind of just walk through it with you chronologically, because you've got a fantastically interesting story, and I'd love to sort of just start at the beginning, really, and then we can sort of touch on all the various kind of adventures that you've had. But to begin with, right at the beginning, you were born in this place called Tiksi, which is also there in the Russian Arctic North. And, you know, you were drawn back to it many years later. So it must have had a real kind of place in your memory. But actually, you were only there really for a few years. You left when you were sort of 7 or 8. So, you know, I'm just wondering how much you really remembered from those very early years of Tiksi, and what, you know, what was it about the place that drew you back there so many years later?
It's true that I lived there only until I was 8 years old, but I think these are probably very important years in a person's life. I think that's probably when the way you look at things and the things that you notice kind of form quite a bit. And we left. I mean, we didn't choose to leave in the sense that, you know, there was a collapse of Soviet Union in 1991 and there was no jobs. And my parents, they were teachers. My mom is teacher of Russian literature and my dad is teacher of biology. And, you know, they just stopped getting salaries at some point, like in so many other places in Soviet Union at that time. So we were kind of forced to move, and it was this massive migration from northern towns. But I feel like I've talked so much about this, and you know, but this is the only story I have. So I had a really, really happy childhood. When I think back of those years in Tiksi, it feels like this, I don't know, it's like as if it's the animation film or something. You know, it was just so full of little adventures and my parents, because it's, you know, such a remote place and there's really not so much to do, especially during the blizzard when there's, you know, you just stay at home. So I think I had a full attention of my parents, and they were very creative and, you know, entertaining us. And, you know, my dad is a very adventurous person, so we would go explore the sea and tundra with him. And he's the one still who never thought that, you know, because I'm a girl, I cannot go hunting or fishing or all these things that men do. And I was very often the only girl in the men company, which is quite rare, still in Russia, but back then, very much so. So I didn't remember that much about Tiksi besides some just, you know, some kind of images or some sparks of, or, you know, some memories and of some situations. And I just wanted to revisit it and see if it really exists. Mm. And I went there when I became a photographer.
Yeah. So then you moved sort of, I don't know what, 1,000 miles away, I think, to the coldest place on Earth, which doesn't, from my point of view, doesn't sound like a terribly appealing idea. I don't suppose it was. Were you upset to leave Tiksi, or was there such a mass exodus that really everyone was kind of leaving?
Yeah, literally, it was. I remember when we were packing, there was all these containers, you know, these shipping containers near everybody's house, and everybody was just moving furniture, things, and everybody were asking each other where they're going. I mean, you know, if you look at numbers, there were about 12,000 people living there when I was growing up, and then at some point it was only 4,000 people, and now I think it's close to 5,000. So it was big migration.
Yeah. What was the place, like, if you spoke to another Russian, what would they think of if you mentioned Tiksi? Was it known for anything? Was it a military place, or what were the things that kind of, you know, people would recognize about on hearing the name of the place?
Well, if people who are connected somehow with Arctic, and, you know, in Arctic is such a huge region, but the population is so small there that if you work in the Arctic, you tend to meet the same people. And when I say to people I meet that I'm from Tiksi, people know, but only people who work in the Arctic. Mm. I think I don't think it's famous in kind of a broader group of people, because it's quite a small place. But for people who worked in the Arctic, it's kind of a legendary place. It's a place where back in Soviet time, people were building careers there, scientists and military people, explorers. It was, you know, when they were building this bright future in the Soviet Arctic, this was the place to do it. There were airplanes going out, exploring the ice situation in the Northern Sea route. It was the big port. you know, it was very lively place. Mm.
What's the name of the place that you then moved to, the cold place?
It's Yakutsk. It's actually quite a big city.
Uh-huh.
It's about 350,000 people. And my parents still live there. That's where I went to school, and I moved from there. I left Yakutsk when I was 16.
Uh-huh. And so when did you start getting interested in photography?
I was an exchange student in American school in Lebanon, Connecticut.
Oh, yeah.
And I was 15, and we had photography class. And there was a really wonderful teacher, Ms. Dunn. She was really passionate about photography, and, you know, we used black and white film and Yashica cameras and darkroom, and it was just, when I started photographing, I just instantly thought that this is the most amazing thing in the world, and I never really looked back after that. Somehow it just stuck with me.
Yeah. What kind of stuff were you interested in photographing in those early days then?
Oh, there. I mean, in the U.S., it was just, you know, you take your camera and just photograph your classmates and, you know, behind the school, in the woods or whatever, you know, make yourself look pretty and things like this.
Yeah, yeah.
But then I came back to Yakutsk and I started working in for local newspapers and kind of I was interested in studio work, actually studio portraiture.
And then you eventually ended up back in the States. You went to New York. So was that all part of your sort of, you know, a plan to sort of take the photography more seriously and or, you know, had did you know right from the beginning that it was what you were going to pursue?
I really wanted to pursue it from the beginning. I just didn't know how. I didn't know if it's a real job that you can have. You know, when you're 16, you're thinking where to go to college and what to do with your life. And when I came back and started photographing, and of course, my parents saw my interest, but they just didn't know. My mom was like, well, okay, Zhenya, you like doing this, but this is not a profession, especially, you know, in Yakutsk and in Russia at that time. I think now it's getting better, but still it's quite challenging to make a career as a photographer in Russia because there is no industry really. And so that kind of all had to remain my hobby. And I went to university studying something that I'm still not sure what I was studying. And then I was traveling. I went traveling with the reindeer herders in Yakutia, and I ended up living with them for 1 year, and just kind of because I wanted to experience that life. But I also started taking pictures, and slowly I realized that, you know, maybe I can be a photographer. Maybe this, you know, this is the kind of photography that people do for National Geographic or, you know, other magazines that I see. And I thought that maybe I can do that.
You decided to go and live with reindeer herders for a year. That seems like a pretty adventurous thing for a young girl to do. But have you always had that sort of adventurous spirit then? Because, yeah, that's kind of an interesting insight into your character in a way.
Yeah, I cannot stay still at all. Like whenever I'm in London for, you know, my husband already can tell by a minute when, you know, I start to have itchy feet and then he knows that I better go because otherwise it's, you know, if I stay, I'm just unbearable. And it's always been like this. And again, it comes from the family. I mean, when, you know, as I was growing up, well, on the weekend, without any plan, my dad could just, you know, announce to everyone that we're going, you know, climb the mountain or, you know, go on catamaran sail somewhere or something like this. So it was, the adventure always seemed very easy and also a very natural way of being in my family for everyone, really. And we like to share. We like to take adventures together, like in A few years ago now, my dad and my brother, we went on dog sleds. We made almost 2,000 kilometers, reaching the point where the Arctic Ocean doesn't freeze. So that was important for us to do because my dad also breeds the husky dogs, riding sled dogs. And it was important for him to do this big trip because he actually created a breed and he registered this Yakutian-like a breed. And his dream was to take this long adventure with his children when his breed is perfect. So, you know, that's how I'm, that's my life kind of.
So when you went to New York, you studied at the ICP. And then did you then stay there and sort of start trying to get, you know, commissions and start working professionally? What were your first kind of breaks?
New York was the most amazing thing that happened to me probably, and I'm so grateful to New York. I mean, it's quite a challenging place, but I can't thank New York enough for many things and for its challenges mostly. And I went to ICP right after that year with the reindeer herders, actually. So it was, you know, I was kind of wild, like a wild animal in New York.
I was going to say it's quite a contrast, but maybe not so much in a way.
But it's the most beautiful contrast. You know, I love contrasts and I love being in the weird states your life. And I think it was perfect actually at the time. You know, I was 25, just coming out of living a year in tundra herding reindeer and then coming to New York and discovering this world of photography. That was I was just so happy that year, learning about photography. I didn't know much, you know, I didn't have access to books or things like this, not because no, in Yakutsk you can't really buy. I did buy some books in Moscow, and obviously there are some museums you can go to and see exhibitions. But in New York, it was so easy, such an easy access to all this great photography and teachers that come and you talk to, you know, people who were, you know, like heroes. So that was a great year. And then I stayed for almost five years, if not six, in New York.
And I guess, you know, coming from where you come from, it being kind of a fairly remote part of the world, was it obvious to you that, you know, you could sort of specialize in that region in a way and you could be, you know, sort of our girl in the Arctic kind of thing for, you know, magazines and people who might commission you to go and do stories there?
No, I didn't think of that in the beginning, and I think what happened was I was trying to to photograph in New York as well, have some commissions, but as you can imagine, it's very hard to do right out of school. But also, I know that at that time I didn't have my personal language or vision or knew who I am. And so what I was doing is I was just mimicking other photographers that I like. And of course, it's just really frustrating. It's you know, what they say in New York is you better know who you are because New York will tell you who you're not. And that's why I'm so thankful actually to New York, because it really made me question a lot, question myself, question what I do, question photography. And my question led me to being absolutely, unsure of myself and thinking, I'm not going to make it as a photographer. I mean, it's obvious. So I kind of wanted to. But I thought before I completely give up, I will just go and do this journey that I wanted to go to always to do, which is to return to Tixi, my hometown. And I did that. And because I already gave up to be a photographer, I just thought that I'll just do whatever I want. I'm not going to think about, you know, other photographers that I like, or I'm not going to think about, you know, how to get a job or things like this. I'm just going to be myself, and this will be my kind of farewell to my attempt, you know, to my dream to be a photographer. And so that lasted for 2 years. I was just so taken by Tixie and the story, and I felt like it's going somewhere, but in a very unpredictable way. I think I was discovering my own kind of language and the way I see as I went. It was quite surprising to me, to see what I'm photographing. And then that project became very popular, and I started winning awards and things like that. And from then on, it just kind of started to people giving me assignments, but also I started working on my own stories also in the Arctic. So
you did this thing in 2013. You went on an icebreaker and you did this kind of great kind of tour, I suppose, of the region, and you stopped at all these meteorological stations. I think there was 22 of them. So you were a couple of months on that vessel. And this is where you came across Slava, this guy who became the subject of your story, Weatherman, which is the first thing I saw of yours. And I remember at the time, just, you know, it really blew me away. And I look at a lot of photography, but it was just so astounding in a way to see something with that aesthetic, really, that you brought to it. So I wanted to ask you about that, because obviously that was a huge sort of inflection point in your journey, in your career. What made you want to go on this icebreaker and visit these places?
Because I just I wanted to see what's there, you know. I wanted to see how people live in this remote places. You know, when you look on the map of Russian Arctic, there are so many little islands, and when I learned that there are people living on these islands, of course I have to go and see it, because, you know, if you look on the map, there are some islands that are, you need to have a really good map, because some islands are really tiny, just, you know, 3 by 4 kilometers, and there are people living there. You know, there's a scientific station in the middle of nowhere, in the middle of Arctic Ocean. And so I was desperate to go there and to see these places. And I learned that there is the only way to get there is by this ship. And it was really the, you know, probably life-changing journey, but also the most frustrating journey, because we had, every time we would land at the station, it would be just for them to unload the supplies, and then we would come back. So it would be just 30 minutes sometimes, from 30 minutes to 2 hours. So it's by the time I'm kind of, get to the point of actually taking pictures, I didn't even take pictures, because I just wanted to see it first, running around, seeing, and but it was great, because then I just mapped out all the places where I need to come back just to spend longer time.
Yeah, and well, I was going to ask you about that. So it's almost like a perfect recce, really, because you're getting to see all these different places for a short period of time with a view to maybe going back to them, and then you get to decide which are the places you want to revisit. I know you were disappointed by a lot of these places. Maybe they weren't quite how you hoped they might be in your imagination. And how do you manage that kind of feeling of disappointment? How do you approach that when you're stuck on a ship for 2 months?
I really hope every time that when I go somewhere, it will be good and I'll be lucky, and that it will all the cards will fall into right places, but there's so many times that things just don't line up, and it's normal. It's okay. And it's a big, big part of my work. And I have so many stories that never been led anywhere, even though I spent a lot of energy, resources on those stories that in my mind, were supposed to happen and were interesting, but they just don't happen, and it's okay. I'm always ready for this kind of, any documentary storyteller, filmmaker, or, you know, for filmmakers, it's even harder if they start working on the film and then they, you know, it's, you kind of just trust your fate and go with it, hoping that mm-hmm. something's going to happen.
Yeah.
So I think, I mean, it's life, you know, it's documentary photography is just life. So sometimes it's, has bright moments, yeah. sometimes it's dull for a very long time.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, ultimately something did happen because you discovered this one particular station where you found Slava. People can find the story on your website. It's called Weatherman, or it's been shown in all kinds of different publications. And I mean, just to quote you, so that you said something like, "This is when you got there. You were like, this is exactly the place. Everything, this whole expedition, me going to study photography, my entire life has led to this encounter." So it was a really significant kind of moment. What was your first impression of him, or what was your first sighting of the guy? What did you, you know, what did you think when you first came across him?
Well, first of all, of course, in terms of things that I saw right away is this narrow peninsula covered in sand, because it was summer. So much sand that you feel like you're inside the sand watch, you call it. And there's this lighthouse, abandoned lighthouse. There is this house with this flowery wallpaper. I mean, everything was as if it was taken from a book or from a dream or something. I mean, it was just overwhelming to see how much character there is in every single thing, in the landscape, in the house, in person, in his gaze, in the way he walks, in the way he talks. And I mean, everything is just so perfect. To me, it was perfect. But for all the people who were on the ship, they were like, "Oh, this is the worst station," you know, like, but, yeah. And I think that probably it's interesting that you read this quote. Is I probably said it when I was, you know, probably a few years ago when I was, kind of, but it did give me, it did leave a very strong impression, and I still sometimes think of Slava and that station, especially during this lockdown. I was thinking a lot about him, actually.
Mm. Yeah. Well, I want to ask you more about him, but basically, I don't know how long you were there for on that first trip, but you went back, and that's when you actually shot the majority, or if not all, of the images. And you must have been quite determined to go back, because you had to hire a helicopter, which can't be cheap. So again, I think that, you know, that seems to indicate you've got you've got a lot of initiative, put it that way. What made you so determined to go back there? And I think you chose to go back in the winter when of course, you know, you've got
for New Year's.
New Year's, right. It was, day after Christmas, I think maybe you went.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously as a photographer who is reliant on, you know, as we all are, on a bit of light, it was an interesting decision to go back at that time of year. Can you just tell me more?
So first I was at the station when I was on board of the ship for about an hour, maybe a bit longer. But it was enough for me to understand that this is the place. And obviously this is a story. I need to come back. And then I came back and I was thinking, and at that time I wasn't even doing, I don't think, the National Geographic assignments, like a bigger assignment. So I was very tight on money, and I couldn't, and I knew that the only way to get there was by helicopter, because there's no roads. And, you know, I cannot wait for the icebreaker in summer. And also I wanted to see how this place looks in winter. I knew that I want to go in deep winter. And it was just miraculously I got this grant from this French foundation that support work that is about sea, And also I managed to sell it, to kind of pre-sell it to Mare magazine, German magazine. And so it was, I was really happy that everything just fell together and I was able to hire the helicopter and do all the things that I need to do and free myself for quite a bit of time. So, but everything happened really fast. I mean, a few months, but in my mind, it was happening really fast. I felt like I need to rush. And why winter? Because I think it's when I saw the place in summer, I thought, oh my God, how does it feel here in winter, in polar night, when, you know, with this heaviness of the darkness and, Yeah.
And so, it sounds like he wasn't particularly fazed by you just showing up there and by helicopter out of the blue. It's, you know, I guess he sort of, he seems to be a kind of almost have a Zen-like, almost, you know, like a Buddhist monk or something approach to life. But yeah, you were there from, I think, a couple of weeks, 2.5, 3 weeks maybe. Well, first of all, let's talk about the photography. Do you think this is where you, in a way, kind of discovered your aesthetic? And do you think, you know, part of it comes from just the necessity of finding a way to make images with these very long exposures and the kind of quality of the light? Because your picture's got this very ethereal kind of almost painterly, you know, quality. I'm sure you've heard that a million times. But yeah, I just wonder how you felt about, you know, on seeing those pictures, whether that you were making there, whether that you'd kind of stumbled upon something.
Well, first of all, the style, the language that you, aesthetics that you're talking about, I think the Arctic landscape and Arctic light is a big part of it. And that's, I feel that my language probably had been shaped by it, by time, because everything in the, not everything in the Arctic, but the stories that I photograph, usually there's not much happening. It's very slow. There's no event, you know, so I couldn't possibly photograph it in a kind of dynamic photojournalistic way. It just too boring to, you know, because there's no way to photograph it. And the only way to photograph it is to wait for this perfect light, and for something to happen. Because everything is so slow in the Arctic and nothing really happens, when something happens, it's so exciting. And that happening might be just light, you know, or just some light, some tones that suddenly appear, or, you know, an unusual gaze of a person that you already have been with for a long time and kind of know a lot about. So yeah, I suppose that, I don't know if it's me looking in a certain way on Arctic, or it's Arctic making me look at things that way. It's probably a combination.
Tell me a little bit about the experience of being in such isolation, you know, with just this one other person who's a complete stranger, and you know, the way in which that has an impact on you psychologically, especially when you've got endless hours of darkness. I guess you have to be pretty good in your own company, but do you find it in some way, you know, a kind of meditative or restful situation to be in?
Yeah, definitely. I felt like I came to myself, actually, even though I was with another person, but I was so myself. And especially at that time, I was already living off my suitcase for a few years. I mean, it's been about 5 years that I had no home at all. Like, I don't know, now thinking back, I have no idea how I'm where, why and how I managed, but I was always on the move. And so in a way, every place I went to, I kind of thought about, oh, how would that feel to be here, to live here? And for me, it was amazing to see how Slava is so much in the perfect place. You know, he's happy where he is, and he doesn't want to be anywhere else. And he's happy with himself, with the place, with everything. And that's why there is no intensity about him. There is no kind of questions. There's no this, you know what I mean? It's just very, very whole person.
Yeah.
And it's always a pleasure to be around people like this, because they make you kind of also calm down and also try to be whole.
Yeah. And, you know, I heard you say that he doesn't get lonely, which seems almost unbelievable, but because he does have a wife who I guess he doesn't see very often. You know, did you talk to him about that? What kind of conversations did you two have together?
Yeah, we talked a lot about different things. I mean, I wasn't, you know, I never really, I guess because I'm not a writer, I never, also, I think it's not polite to ask people too many things that, you know, I would never go and like try to do any soul searching or, you know, I always just leave it to people, whatever they want to say. I'm just there. We were talking about different things, but he was getting tired quite quickly because he's not used to talking, and he's always quiet. So sometimes we would talk, and then he would be like, "Okay, that's all for now. I kind of got really tired."
What kind of,
you know, what I think the talking part is sometimes, and especially up north, people are so used to not talking much, and there's so many things you can know about each other without talking, and that's just by the way you behave. You understand people immediately. People up north have such scanner, you know, of how just by the way you enter the room and how you behave or what you say the first time you see someone, and it's enough often, and more than enough, and you don't need to say things.
Yeah, because I know it's important to you to sort of, you know, get to know your subjects well and form relationships. You're not the sort of photographer who just starts taking pictures straight away. Sometimes you don't take pictures for quite a long time. So, you know, clearly for you, there's a lot of emphasis put on, you know, kind of getting to know people. I think that, one of the other places you went to was another station, a lighthouse station where there was a couple. And I think that applied in that case, that you spent quite a lot of time kind of getting to know them before you even started taking pictures. Can you sort of talk a little bit about, you know, the importance of that for you?
To be honest, I don't like to be photographed myself, and that's why I really understand why people don't, you know, the act of taking pictures is very invasive, you know, and it's a very harsh thing to do to someone, I think, you know, and I'm very much aware of that, so I want to soften it as much as I can for people, and to the point when it won't be about photography. Or if it's about photography, it's about me telling, kind of making them understand what I do and them wanting to help me. Very often it works like this. It's like, okay, Zhenya, you know, what can we do for you, you poor thing? You got here, you know, you're
well, it's not like they don't
how
know.
How can we help you?
They know what you're there for. It's quite astonishing for them to see anyone at all, let alone, you know, to have a photographer come. So it's not as though they're going to be shocked when you finally get the camera out. They're probably thinking, when's she going to actually start taking
pictures? Exactly.
She's a bit weird.
Yeah, that happens quite often, actually, because sometimes people are just like, I was with them. Because I'm just there hanging out, talking or not talking or whatever. And once it was with the reindeer herders when I was already on assignment for Geographic. And one family were like, so when are you going to start working? What will your magazine say? You haven't been working at all. I'm like, okay, yes. Now I can take pictures.
Yeah. People get it, I think, so much more than one might imagine. But I think, and again, you went at the worst, well, one, it depends how you look at it, but what you could think was is the worst time of year. There were blizzards and stuff. I guess it gets whited out. Again, you don't make life that easy for yourself sometimes in terms of these decisions. But I don't know. Yeah, I think, and what was it, 17-hour snowmobile ride or something. Mm-hmm. Can you tell why go at that time of year in that case?
Because I wanted to photograph the blizzard. And it's not, you know, when you talk about, and I do get asked that a lot. And, you know, I did say that, you know, it took me 17 hours and all this. And the travel logistics are very complicated. But compared to people who actually live there, it's nothing. You know, this is how people live. This is how people, you know, to get somewhere, it takes exactly this. And so I'm, you know, and I just think, okay, well, if you need to do that, you need to do that. I don't think of it as something super, you know, crazy.
Yeah, I know. I mean, I guess it. Well, you know, having those experiences, it just kind of gives you an insight into the challenges that these people that you're going to be photographing face, you know, on a daily basis.
What I wanted to say is that, of course, for people who haven't never been in the Arctic or been just, you know, for a short time, it can seem very challenging, and it is. But you just have to be prepared. You have to be careful and all of these things. But it's all possible. You know, people live in these conditions. People have been living for centuries in these conditions, even worse. And I guess because I've been working for so long in the Arctic and I was born there, for me, these are not obstacles. These are just things to consider in order to get somewhere. But it's not... Mm. It's just, you know, it's like, it can be difficult at times, but I don't regard it as, you know, something to be applauded for. Let's put it.
No, I get what you're saying. But at the same time, the decision, you know, for the people that you're photographing to sort of, you know, take yourself to such a remote place and to be away from other people, you know, because, you know, human beings, we're very tribal and we're very gregarious. We get together in big groups. That's why we build cities. So it is an extraordinary decision to make. It's an extraordinary way to live, which is obviously one of the reasons why you're drawn to go and photograph these people in these places. And, you know, Evgenia and I can't remember, so her
Ivan.
Husband's name or her mm-hmm. Ivan's, you know, are an example of that. You know, I mean, he wrote on a sort of hut that, you know, they were at the edge of the world. I mean, you know, that's about all you need to know in a way.
These are the real heroes, actually. These are the people who, you know, they don't post about it on Instagram. They don't give interviews, you know, and they're doing the most extreme living. And that is why when, you know, it compared to these brave people, what I do is nothing, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I think, as you said yourself, it's not for everyone, which is a sort of understatement of the century in a way. I guess the other place would be nice to sort of hear about is Dixon and your experience there, because there you were there again during the polar night. I think your brother was with you, though, so you had a bit of company. But, you know, as you've already mentioned at least once, there's part of the problem is there's very, very little happening in a way, and there's, you know, you've got to find things photo off. But you did, you were rewarded for your patience because, you know, the Aurora Borealis came along and you managed to photograph it. And I've got this picture of you running around like a crazy person just for the few hours that this was happening, which I think is more or less what happened, isn't it? But maybe you could just tell me in your own words rather than me trying to put words into your mouth. How did that all come about, and tell us a little bit about the experience of when that magical kind of moment finally came.
Yeah, that was a magical moment indeed, something that I was hoping for, but I didn't anticipate that it will be such a gift, really. And these are the moments when you think, you know, when everything just aligns and you think, oh, that's what I'm here for, you know, or, yeah. Okay, that's what, because sometimes, you know, especially when you plan the trips and it's this so much logistical kind of a puzzle and, you know, because you need to find a place where to live, because there's no, you know, we were again staying at the meteorological station, and so we had to walk to this town every day, and there was quite a lot of polar bears, and you know, we didn't have a gun, so it was a lot of things that you just keep you on your toes, just kind of annoying things that you just need to be mindful and that don't let you fully focus on photography. So lots of like stresses like this that you kind of need to shut. Why I went there during polar night, because again, I thought that would be a great idea to photograph the ghost town in the night. Mm-hmm. And also polar night is kind of, you know, in a way associated with this deep sleep or death or whatever you want to call it, just this kind of still absolute stillness, which is not true, actually. There are so many things happening. But in my mind, kind of visually, I thought that this would be a good time to photograph the town that was abandoned. And it's kind of this dream that never came true. And now this dream kind of covered in darkness of polar night. You know, I had this kind of poetic vision. And so I thought it would be a good idea. And we went with my brother. My brother comes with me often as an assistant. He helps me. He's also a filmmaker. So we're a great team. And he, you know, he's very savvy in this conditions, expeditions and all these things. So for 2 weeks, we were walking dark streets, going into every single room. It was quite, you know, it was 2,000 people living there at some point. Every room, just looking at remains and what, you know, I was interested to see what people left behind. Also looking at this beautiful textures of frost covering different objects. But the light was not good. And I was already kind of about starting to think, okay, this will be that one of those stories that never came to be, you know. But then, yeah, one night, out of the blue, we went again, we were walking, and then I saw just a little glimmer, and I'm like, Max, I think this is starting. And then it grew and grew, and I'm like, okay, this is it. And he was also excited, and he was like, okay, I'm going to go, because we both wanted to do our thing. He went to do his filming, and I went to my things, to do my things, because at that time, I already knew exactly where I need to run. And I didn't know how long this aurora gonna last. So I had to really run, even though it was really cold. I was all sweaty, you know, running, trying to make it, you know, and then trying also to control my emotions, because what, you know, when you have this amazing light and you know it's going to last only for a short while, you kind of have to make priorities. Okay, what do I need to photograph? And that's the hardest part, because you don't know. And the places I wanted to photograph are quite far from each other. So I had to run from one side of town to another, go into that room. So it was a really intense few hours, but it was absolutely beautiful.
On a kind of technical level, you're on the tripod and you're using what sort of length of exposures do you need when you're photographing at the darkest that you sort of bother to take the lens cap off? Are you at sort of a minute long or something like, or longer, or what?
Yeah, sometimes I go even longer. I mean, it depends on where I photograph. Inside, it can be longer. Outside, you know, if at night, I don't like this effect of moving stars, so I have to be mindful of that, and the exposure can be too long. But inside, in Dixon, for example, the shots that were made inside, they are really long. Some of them are 2.5 minutes. Something like that.
Because the only thing that's interesting about that is that I'm wondering, you know, the way in which the kind of, because you shoot digitally, don't you, and the way in which, you know, the sensor is kind of responding to that length of exposure, it just seems that might be part of the way in which you've created this very kind of a distinctive look, in a way, is just that, you know, your choice of the way that works and how that has a weird effect on the ultimate picture. I don't know if you've thought about that too much. I'm sure you do a certain amount of post production. I know you don't do much photoshopping, so it's just what's kind of been captured, in a way. And I'm wondering if, I know people have got a thing about film, but maybe it wouldn't actually work so well if you were trying to do it on film. I'm not sure. You know, digital sensors are pretty sensitive in bad light. It's one of the things they're really good for. So, you know, it's kind of a rare foray into the world of, you know, the technical side of things on this podcast, really. But I'm interested in it.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't be able to photograph in film. It's just the film is too gentle and fussy for the places I go. And also the ISO limitations are just not acceptable for me, because I often work in dark conditions. I think I love doing long exposures, obviously, because it just, you're right, it creates this very surreal look. And but also I like that I can photograph something that I don't really see, and that's even more magical for me to in the moment to photograph it and see, oh wow, you know, like I could see this constellation, but I don't see it with my bare eye. And that's, I really enjoy that.
Yeah.
And in terms of cameras, I mean, I really wish, sometimes I wish I used other, you know, cameras, but most of the cameras are just too gentle for what I do. And my Canon remains this, you know, workhorse for most conditions, because it's just unbreakable.
Yeah. Also, you're going to the kind of the kind of places you go to. You don't really want to be waiting to process film to see if you got the picture. You much rather, know what you've got at the time.
But also, I really spent quite a long time. I do quite a bit of drafts with my camera. So if you look at an image. Some images I have variations, lots of variation of the same image in the span of a year. So I for example, I like a place and then I take a picture and I perfect it to, and or I know that I need to wait for a certain light or for a person to come into the frame or something. So but I like to look at my drafts. I play with them. I even sometimes put them together. not as a story, almost like not the actual photographs, but drafts of the potential photographs and play with them. And just in that way, it helps me to create and to work on the thread of the story.
Right. Okay. Yeah, that's interesting. So you're sort of refining the idea of what you want as you go through these different iterations, and then you can finally get the image that you really were looking for.
Mm-hmm.
Just to sort of to sort of move on by way of contrast, in a way, I wanted to ask you about the story you did in Tanzania, which was you've entitled Amani or Amani. Now, you know, you couldn't have a bigger contrast, really, in terms of the geography and the kind of nature of the light that you're dealing with, and you still achieved a really kind of consistent aesthetic to it. You know, although it's a very different kind of color palette, I suppose color palette is the word I'm looking for, which is kind of a signature of your work, I think. How did you kind of go about rising to that challenge? You know, was it weird in a way to be in such a totally contrasting environment in terms of the color palette that you were presented with and the quality of the light and that kind of thing?
Yeah, it was. Well, first of all, it was my first time ever in Africa. And so, of course, it was overwhelming, and especially with all this vegetation. You know, I'm used to working in tundra with no trees.
Yeah.
And here's this beautiful forests, and I had a wonderful time there. But because it was, the story started in quite unusual for me way, because it was a collaboration with anthropologists who were already been doing research there for quite some time. And what they were researching was the dreams and hope, the dreams of people who used to work at the station. The actual dreams, like sleeping dreams and dreams of like aspirations. And when I read their paper, it was so interesting. And I thought, okay, well, this is exactly kind of what I like to work with this kind of, you know, point in time when it's not past and it's not present and it's not future just yet. So it's kind of this in-between moments, a lot of it quite, you know, kind of almost nostalgic feelings and things like this. So this was perfect. And that's in that way, even though it was a different light and different continent and different nature, it was very similar in the space, in the mind space, in the psychological mm-hmm. space that I usually work in. So that yeah. allowed me to kind of tune in quite quickly into how to capture that.
Mm-mm, yeah. Yeah, because I think this theme of kind of stories and dreams and kind of maybe this allusion to a kind of fictional or a kind of magical realism, all that stuff that you already were exploring, you know, is very much kind of evident in this story.
Yeah, and then in the color palette, the way, you know, color palette is just a tool to tell the story. So when you think about, you know, first I think about what's the story and what is the and you know what's the meaning of color and or what's the story and how do I use color to tell the story or to accentuate on certain things. So in Amani, there's a lot of kind of dark colors and it all refers to things that I've learned during my stay in Tanzania. But it took me a long time. I mean, I was supposed to be there just a few days, a couple of times, but I said, I have to stay and to understand this place more. So I ended up living there for almost 3 months to kind of get into it.
Mm. Well, we didn't mention, but it was a malaria research station, and Amani is the man that is the subject of it, a bit like a kind of counterpart to Slava, really, in a weird way, maybe not so isolated, but still this kind of lone character that you've chosen to focus on. Tell me a little bit about who he is?
Well, actually, the Amani is the name of the place.
The place. Okay, sorry.
Of the area. Yeah, it means peace in Swahili. And the man who I photographed is John Mganga. And he's actually, I mean, you know, if people who know him, they wouldn't say that he's necessarily lonely. He has a family and mm-hmm. all this. And he isn't a loner, so to speak. But I felt that the way I want to tell, but he is very much, you know, when we were talking about dreams and memories of this place, of the past of this place, of this big scientific future that never happened for this place, in his dreams and in his memories, he was quite alone because there's no more of scientists, or, you know, the station as it was doesn't exist anymore. So in that respect, there is his solitude in that, but not so much in his actual life. So, yeah. I met him, and he's this very kind, warm person. He was showing me around and telling his stories, and through his stories, I started to think how I want to photograph it.
Mm. Now, I hope there's going to be a book coming at some point. I don't know if you're anywhere. I don't know how far through that you are, if at all. Maybe you're still thinking about it, but it's certainly something that I think a lot of people would like to see come from you. Is that something you're planning?
Yes, definitely. I'm planning to do a book, and this would be a book about Arctic. There's four stories that we just talked about that are also now showing at the Photographer's Gallery, and I feel it is a one story. It's kind of one story with four different chapters. So yes, it will be a book. I do plan to sit down with it in 2021 on January 1st.
As
soon as yes, it's coming. I just, because it's such a special work for me personally, and there's quite a lot of memories and writings and diaries to go through, that I just want to really take my time with this to make it, you know, good.
Yeah, absolutely. What else are you sort of planning for the near future, assuming that we can still travel around next year? What have you got on the horizon? Are there any assignments in the pipeline, or you know, return trips to the Arctic? Just give us a little flavor of what you've got coming up. Maybe there's stuff you're looking forward to. I don't know.
Oh, there are so many things. Well, also, I am now started to experiment with moving image and with filmmaking, and this is something that I'm really, really excited about. But it's all very, very new, and it's kind of feel really nice to have this free fall, it feels very fresh to be in, not to know, you know, how to kind of know, but not really. So I'm doing that, and that's what, all this year, actually, I didn't take a single picture. It was all video.
Oh, really? Huh.
We are now with my brother, and now we're working on, we're processing it and just seeing what it will lead us, where it will lead us. Some assignments. I'm obviously just trying to figure out how to work in the current climate. It's obviously very challenging to work on human stories and long form storytelling now. So I think I'll wait, maybe, because it just feels like it's not the right time. But yeah, some assignment stories are also in the lineup.
Good. Yeah. Good. Well, look forward to seeing whatever you produce, and thank you so much for talking to me about your lovely work. I enjoy seeing it very much. So, yeah, I appreciate you
taking
the time again.
Thank you. Yeah, it was a pleasure to chat.